This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Eric Jacobson. I'm the CEO of the Battle of Franklin Trust. We manage three historic homes related to the Battle of Franklin in Middle Tennessee.
And briefly, your background, historian?
Historian, author, written three books, nonfiction books about the Battle of Franklin, the campaign through this area. But I came out of the for-profit world. That was really my background. But history was, it's like baseball, you know.
Yeah.
It was just
a passion,
in me.
Yeah,
from the beginning.
Tell us about where we are right now.
It's Episcopal Church, a little community known as Ashwood, but it's midway between Columbia, Tennessee and Mount Pleasant. Incredibly historic place, pre-war church. The Polk family reigned supreme in this area.
They were the largest farm family in the area?
Yeah, they owned thousands of acres. They're growing everything imaginable, corn, grain, but large amounts of cotton. You know, everybody around here close to the Polks were flush with money, but the cemetery behind the church has a close connection to the Battle of Franklin because three of the Confederate generals who died at Franklin were buried here for several years after the war.
That was one of the last major battles of the Civil War, right? Was it November 64?
November 30th, 1864. We describe it as the last major battle of the war. I mean, there's nothing of that scope and size and those kinds of casualties.
And what was the confluence? What happened and why?
John Bell Hood, the Confederate commander, is attempting to retake Nashville, which has been held by U.S. troops since early in the war. U.S. Army, commanded by John Schofield, essentially gets trapped in Franklin. They can't get across the river quick enough. Hood jumps on him right before sundown. There's some initial success by the Confederate forces, but the tide soon turned, and then it turns into this really bloody, awful fight.
Hand-to-hand.
Hand-to-hand, spills into the darkness. Half the battle's in the pitch black of night, and the casualties are just immense. 2,500 dead, 7,000 wounded, 1,000 missing.
And the majority of the casualties were the Southerners, right?
Yeah, about 7,500 of the 10,000 casualties were Confederates.
And this is in 24, 36-hour period?
This is in about 4.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, the battle lasts from 4 o'clock to about 8. Wow. Spasms of it continue for an hour or so, but it's a short, brutal, almost fiendish kind of fight.
Yeah. And then that whole dynamic, the battle is over, but the battlefield is littered with wounded and dying and dead,
right?
People, just that infrastructure. You know, how do you remove the bodies? Where do you take the wounded? And I remember some of them came here, correct? This became a hospital.
There were some wounded, some Confederate wounded who ended up here, but I mean, the bulk of the Confederate wounded are being tended to in a number of places in Franklin, including Carnton, one of the sites we manage. But, you know, the wounded are being moved in a myriad of directions. The dead were mostly buried the day after the battle, so December 1st, by the Confederate Army and some U.S. troops who'd been captured. So they buried close to 2,500 men that morning.
Wow. And just that other side of the war, the medics, the MDs, the nurses.
I mean, yeah, Civil War surgeons, they get credit where we work, but a lot of them, they're still considered butchers and
right.
hacks. This is a dedicated group of people trying to save lives, and mm-hmm. by 1864, they'd had a lot of practice, and they saved a great many men that night who would have otherwise died.
In medicine, what did we learn?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know, I think the most important thing that we learned was what was inside the body cavity. You know, that kind of surgery was in its bare infancy, and these surgeons saw the insides of human beings for years, and so they kind of learned what makes us tick. And the doctors who survived the war and then went on, they profoundly changed modern medicine. And then they found out what germs and bacteria were after the war, and that it was one of the greatest leaps in modern medical history.
Isn't that interesting? The perverseness of battles and war creates these mega advancements in medicine technology.
Yeah, it forces people to adjust and change and to do things they certainly... It isn't even whether they're comfortable, it's that they'd never even think about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they had to, and they learned new things.
moment about revisionist history. Talk to us about the lost cause and the war of northern aggression. Which I always believed, I thought, was there forever.
You know, the war of northern aggression is a completely modern term.
I thought that was coined post-Civil War.
Nope, the Confederate soldiers never said it. It was largely created around the time of the centennial in the 1960s. I think it was sort of a funny way for Southerners to refer to the war when it's just not historic. But revisionism, history's being revised all the time. We learn new things. We find out things we thought were true are not. So, revisionism can turn into what you might call political correctness run amok. Mm-hmm. But sometimes what people call political correctness isn't that. Sometimes it's just correct. Mm-hmm. They just don't like to hear it. And I think the lost cause, which was this kind of idyllic view of the war created really in Virginia and Tennessee, that slavery wasn't really a big part of the reason for the war. It was incidental. The South was right. And the North was wrong. Well, once you had those three pillars constructed, you had the lost cause. And that lives in the schoolrooms and in the college dorm rooms and on battlefields and in the public square. And it has great sway over, I would say, probably five or six generations of white Southerners. But I can tell you this. There's always been a group of people in the South who never succumbed to the virtues of the lost cause. Mm-hmm. And that was the black population of the South.
Interesting.
Because the lost cause to them never made any sense. And when the Confederate flag was being waved at you during desegregation, there wasn't anything idyllic about that. And so we're starting to see the lost cause being replaced by what I would say is a more accurate and appropriate view of history.
Let's talk a moment about Hollywood's place in functional history in the 20th century, starting with Woodrow Wilson.
You mean Birth of a Nation?
Yes, sir.
Well, yeah. Birth of a Nation is the crystallization of the lost cause. You have people running around in blackface. The Ku Klux Klan are presented, because that movie's based on The Invisible Empire, I think was the book. The Klan were the heroes. They were the heroes saving the virtues of the white women of the South from these godless Yankees and hordes of black men running around. So I can say this without any hesitation. That is one of the most damaging things this country has gone through. It's a legacy we live with, and it was not created by Confederate veterans. It was not even created by those who instituted or inaugurated Civil War. It was these generations afterward who, they left us with a terrible legacy. Mm-hmm. But we are beginning to unravel. And, of course, Wilson thought it was so great.
Yeah, he showed it in the White House.
He showed it at the White House. But we all know Wilson was, I think,
he's the one that segregated the United States Postal Service.
He removed every black person from a government job. He was, without a doubt, I think the most prejudiced person that's ever sat in the Oval Office.
And I grew up so proud of that guy.
Right.
The League of Nations. Yeah.
Well, it's an example of when you start to learn more than what you've been told, suddenly history, it's not a sugary sweet then.
Mm-hmm. One more, I think, a seminal moment that still lives on is Gone with the Wind, 1939.
More lost cause romance, although not nearly on the level of the Birth of a Nation, but it's
more refined, but it's putting a spotlight on the same
Mammy is beloved. So, slaves must have been like Mammy, and of course Sherman is, he's the devil, and everything about that. Ironically, Rhett Butler, where does he go? Franklin. He goes to Franklin at the end. But, Gone with the Wind was also, there was an apocryphal story years ago that when an aging widow, I may have some of this wrong, but let's just say an old woman read Margaret Mitchell's book on a cold winter's night in New Hampshire. And when she finished the book, she slammed it shut and she said, those damn Yankees. And at that point, 80 years after the Civil War, the South had won. They'd won the war.
Right.
They'd won the literary war. They'd won the war in the public square. Segregation was the rule. Jim Crow was firmly in place. Mm-hmm. The U.S. military was still segregated.
Yeah.
So they had won. And mm-hmm. that's tough, because there are still people alive who saw Gone with the Wind when they were young, and trying to get them to understand that it isn't that they were wrong, it's just that maybe the facts they were given weren't really facts all along.
Devil's Advocate, defend the South and the Southerners at the end of Civil War.
I don't.
It's going against your brain cells.
No, it's just one of those what ifs. I think if you were white and you lived in the South, in one of the 11 states that seceded, by and large, you didn't have a lot of choice. Now, if you lived in an area where there was some Unionist sympathies, those men remained loyal.
But again,
they're fighting to defend what they saw as a way of life.
But generations and generations, that's all you know. That's your world.
Right.
And you can't,
it is.
You can't see it through a contextual lens.
It is. I don't think it's about defending them, and I don't think it's about indicting them.
Right.
I think it's about simply saying these people led a secession movement, and soldiers fought ultimately to defend slavery and destroy the United States of America. There are countless human beings in the history of this world who've died for the wrong cause. Mm-hmm. And I think today we're going through a catharsis about Vietnam. Was it worth it? Did those men die for a just cause? The only way to get to the truth is to be able to ask yourself that question. And I think that's one of the problems here. Bravery and heroism are one thing, but were they fighting for the right cause? Mm-hmm. I think history clearly tells us the right side won the war. The ending of slavery and the preservation of the Union was the result of that war, and there was a tremendous punishment that had to be paid by both sides.
Where are we going?
I think to a better place. Okay. I see younger people, and when I say younger, you know, 35, 40 or 35 and under, they have a much better sense of the realities.
Why do you think there's a break?
Because I think they were the children born of parents who came after civil rights. My generation was born right on the cusp of that breakdown, and it's my children's generation and their, so my grandchildren, those subsequent ones, are post-civil rights, post-black man can be a quarterback of a football team conversations, post-Barack Obama. So the world has changed. They don't carry the baggage that you and I might have. They don't see a need to defend what seems to them to be the indefensible. That doesn't mean they think everybody in the past was evil,
right.
But they also can clearly see some things just aren't worth the energy to defend.
Are they critical thinkers?
I do, but differently than perhaps you and I are.
Uh-huh.
I think they are, in a strange way, more critical thinkers about the collective. And as the old saying goes, e pluribus unum. You know, we are individuals. We like that John Wayne ruggedness.
Right.
But I think that we are also one. I think individualism is what led us to a war. An individual who could own other human beings who then thought he could secede and destroy the country. I think they are critical thinkers, just in a different way.
That's really cool.
I think that whether you're 20, 40, or 80, to really learn how the Civil War redefined this country, you have to come to Middle Tennessee. This is where it ends. This is where the Ku Klux Klan
was birthed.
This is what town
was it?
Pulaski, Giles County, just south of here. But this is the state where Martin Luther King was assassinated. This was the place in Columbia, Tennessee, where the Columbia Race Riot of 1946 occurred. This is where Andrew Johnson and Andrew Jackson were from. Johnson, of course, who took over for Lincoln. There's so much history in this state that is critical to understanding the 100 years from the Civil War to civil rights. And that's the redefining moment in our history. My name is Eric Jacobson. I'm the CEO of the Battle of Franklin Trust. And for more information, you can just visit our website, boft.org.
Eric, thank you so much for sharing. Very illuminating.
My pleasure.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.